I had a behind the scenes book of the Two Towers, and but I had it when I was too young to appreciate what I was being told, really, and I was just mostly looking at it for references to draw pictures of the characters.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm.
Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm. I am your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers, and this is the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. And today, we're talking about one of my absolute most favouritest things, which is The Lord of the Rings. And I am totally stoked to be joined by Gavia, Jeffrey, and Sue. We're going to do a little round of introductions. We'll go alphabetically as always. So, Gavia, can you give us your pronouns and tell us what you do?
Hi, Gavia Baker-Whitelaw, she, her, and I am a film critic and fandom journalist, so I will be talking probably mostly about Lord of the Rings movies, which I love a great deal.
Oh, I look forward to that. And Jeffrey, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hi, this is Jeffrey Nils Gardner. Pronouns they, them, status as second best Rusty Quiller. And I am Rusty Quill's mastering editor.
Wonderful. And finally, Sue, give us your pronouns and tell us who you are.
I'm Sue Sims, pronouns she, her, and your majesty. And I have been playing on and off Gertrude in the Magnus Archives for several years.
Indeed you have.
Is on and off Gertrude the robot version?
Oh, a sci-fi version of the Magnus Archives where everyone's robots. That would be fun. I mean, we were talking before the recording about the different vibes of Lord of the Rings, where in some places it feels like things are following fairy tale logic, and in some places it feels more like sort of mythology or legends. I was wondering if anyone had any thoughts on that, because in a previous episode on Lord of the Rings, in the pilot season over on Patreon, we had some thoughts about how characters like Tom Bombadil sort of follow fairy tale logic, but characters from other parts and in other places of the book feel much more grounded and realistic. I'd be interested to hear what people think about that.
I think the problem with Tom Bombadil, I agree about the fairy tale aspect. I think the reason is that when Tolkien started writing Lord of the Rings, he really didn't have a clue what he was doing. I mean, he said this himself. this is not a criticism. He knew he was writing a sequel to The Hobbit, and he knew there was going to be quite a lot of hobbitry in it. Mm-hmm. But he really didn't have much idea of where he was going at this stage. So he put Tom Bombadil in because Tom Bombadil was a small wooden doll that actually belonged to one of his sons.
Oh!
And he thought, you know, it'd be rather fun. He'd already written various verses, which were much, much, much later on. I think in the late 60s, I can't remember exactly, they were published as the Adventures of Tom Bombadil. And there are various poems about, you know, what he did and about Goldberry. If you want to read about his courting of Goldberry, that's where you go. But the great problem is
I had no idea that it was based on a doll.
Yeah, certainly it was. But the problem was, of course, that as the story went on, Tom Bombadil becomes less and less relevant. And that's why Peter Jackson could cut him out of the film without anyone really missing him. I mean, I didn't, because I never terribly liked Tom Bombadil anyway. But I don't know, did the rest of you miss him from the films?
I mean, I didn't, but I read the books precisely once before seeing the films at the age of 11. So although I remember the books, they are perhaps not as wedded to my image of the movies. But like in terms of the different tones, I think that's part of the reason why like such a wide variety of people kind of engage with the story, because you've got some parts that are so cozy, all of the hobbits, and then you've got some parts that feel like these huge epic tales. And obviously Tolkien was kind of drawing from all this mythology. Like he was really influenced by stuff like Beowulf. He was extremely influenced by Norse sagas and mythology and like the Song of the Nibelungs, which later became the Ring Cycle by Wagner. So he's like very influenced by that, which is also a story about, you know, dwarves and elves and a magical ring. And Gandalf kind of has these resemblances to Odin. So he is really drawing from all that stuff. And like he basically, as an academic, was obviously like a linguist and was only interested in literature that happened kind of before medieval times. Like for him, Shakespeare was too modern. So that's kind of why it has this tone, and it's had this knock-on effect to other fantasy writers.
I think there's a thing there also in that it always felt to me, and maybe it was just that these were kind of the stories I grew up with simultaneously, the Iliad and Greek history and mythology and Tolkien. I think that there is a piece of it that is, I'm going to say epic with a capital E rather than mythology, in that like the disconnect of like, were these real people? Were these not? This is just history, even though it is obviously fantastical, kind of gets blurred in the way, you know, yeah, of a an Iliad, a Herodotus, maybe even that this is an early kind of history.
That completely makes sense. That's such a good point, because it's like Tolkien is writing from the perspective of embedding himself in this world that he's created. And it's like, people talk about escapism, but no one had as much escapism in his life as Tolkien. Because like, he started creating, you know, Quenya, the Elvish language, when he was like 17 or 18, when he just started undergrad.
Oh.
And he was completely obsessed with this world for his entire life. So, I mean, he wanted to be in Middle-earth. Like, he kind of thought of himself as a hobbit type person, like in terms of his own personality. And obviously, like when he was a young man, he lived through World War One, which you can really kind of tell in the books and the movies, because it's all these stories which have this sense of kind of pain and grief, but also nostalgia. So he was kind of escaping from the real world into this ancient saga that he'd created of a world that I think kind of felt real to him.
I feel like whenever, as a writer, whatever you create does feel real to you in some way, otherwise you probably wouldn't be making it. And the amount of words that he wrote about this world and about this mythos, I can absolutely see it being a form of escapism. Because that's also, you know, that's part of the reason why I write. I'm like, well, let me think about other people's problems for a while and let's make them worse than mine so I can feel better.
Gavio, what you're saying there really, it makes a lot of sense. I think back to when I was first encountering these stories. I think my father read The Hobbit to me at 4, and we kind of read it or talked about it or Lord of the Rings just about every year since. So much of the story is nested in that, like, you know, the ages of the world and like the idea that like, no, this is Earth. This is, you know, elves have gone away now, sure, but like these humans are the same humans we have here. It's just this is way back in the day. And, you know, hobbits are there if you look for them. They just don't really come out much anymore. Yeah, that was always, I think it's there in the text, but also, you know, consuming it at a very young age, I think they all had that air of like, oh, this is a reality that we could step into pretty easily. And there's so much infrastructure behind everything in The Lord of the Rings, you know, through the Silmarillion, that was unlike something like, you know, the Star Wars universe, where it's created by hundreds of people over time. It's really just this incredible amount of backstory built by just, you know, one person, or, you know, I guess one person and his son completing things.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. From a reader's point of view, it can really be escapism. And you're quite right, of course, about Tolkien. The languages, I think, weren't escapism, but the stories probably were. But we do tend to use that word escapism, don't we, very negatively. Do you remember the, was it called, actual conversation? I think it was between Lewis and C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, when Tolkien had been accused of escapism, and Lewis said, well, yes, but who would be most worried about people escaping? Answer, jailers.
Yeah, I'm on Lewis's side. I don't think that escapism is a dirty word. And I think that if none of us were able to escape into our imaginations, I think we would all go even madder than we all are right now.
I don't think there's going to be many anti-escapism voices on this podcast.
That's true.
And what a world to escape into, if you think. I mean, like, yeah. It is a world where there is, you know, evil with a capital E and dangerous creatures and war. But it's also a world in which, you know, no one gets sick. People die, but it is in service of a greater good, and it's not random or small or sad. Well, sad maybe, but.
And there's lots of delicious descriptions of food.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the Silmarillion, I would argue there's definitely. I'm sure people do get sick. There are definitely people who die of having broken hearts.
Well, but that's like the opposite of a small, inconsequential death. That is feeling so deeply.
Oh.
Whereas I think there's a cause and a meaning to death.
I see. So you're talking about how nothing feels.
It's not accidental.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not just random chance.
Which definitely makes sense.
I want to go back briefly because, Jeffrey, you said that your dad read, was it Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit to you when you were four?
We started with The Hobbit, yeah. I was given a copy of The Hobbit when my baby sister, she now has a 2-year-old of her own, so not so much baby sister anymore. But at my sister's birth, I was given a beautiful copy of The Hobbit with these gorgeous oil paintings, I believe, all throughout. I still have it. It looks like an ancient tome. It's weathered and, you know, cracked and pages browning and all that.
So so you clearly heard or read the books before you saw the films?
Yes, yeah.
Is that true for the other two of you, Gavi or Sue?
Yeah. I read the books when I was 11, right before the movies came out.
Mm.
So I was kind of right at like the apex of the millennial generation that were just like obsessed with Lord of the Rings in our early teens when it like came to yet another really big audience. So I think I read the books either once or twice, but I still feel like I remember them much better than most books I would have read, because obviously I've seen the films so many times and they're kind of part of the pop culture discourse still.
As for me, I talked about reading The Hobbit, certainly well before the films.
Yes.
the films didn't come out. I think the first film was 2001, I think.
Mm.
And
yes.
By that time I was, much, much older than the rest of you. But yeah, reading The Hobbit, on the back flap of the dust jacket, there was a little sort of puff for Lord of the Rings, and it was quite clearly it was a grown-up book, and I was 7. I thought, well, I will read these when I'm 12. And
aww.
I did. I saved up my pocket money and my Christmas money, and then I went out and I bought all 3 volumes of The Lord of the Rings.
It's the ideal
age. I still have.
Yeah.
Well, it was amazing, and then I just sort of submerged myself in them for days and days. I don't think my parents got anything out of me at all.
You would never find me without, in general, you'd never find me without a book when I was a kid. I just took a book everywhere with me, no matter where I was going.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So that's really interesting, because my first introduction to Lord of the Rings was the films. I remember seeing the advert on the television, and there was that shot of Frodo and like when he puts the ring on in Bree. And that shot, it's very golden, and like the ring is coming up towards the camera and his finger is just coming up
into
it.
Yes, yes.
I remember that so vividly, not because of the films, but I remember that advert and I was like, this looks interesting. And I made my dad take me to see it.
I mean, it's really a testament to the quality of the visual imagery in those movies. Like they are just incomparably good in terms of like Hollywood releases, just unbelievable movies.
Yes, they are incredible.
Yes.
I mean, the Return of the King, of course, won all those Oscars, but they were really being given for the whole trilogy, weren't they? And not just for... In the way that C.S. Lewis got the Carnegie Medal for The Last Battle, but obviously it was really for the whole of the seven Narnia books. But, I thought the films were... I didn't expect to enjoy them, but I really did.
I mean, they're really eye-opening in the context of, like, other big Hollywood blockbusters, because there was pretty much nothing apart from Star Wars that's at that caliber of filmmaking. And, you know, they've got this incredible cast. Obviously, we all know the cast of Lord of the Rings is perfect and amazing. But it's, you know, the level of craft and kind of care that was put into that is not something you see in any other blockbuster franchise, because, you know, there's so many cooks involved in cooking the meal, you know, and they're not made by people who really care about it. And it really does feel like a fluke, you know, that Peter Jackson was able to get this massive army of artisans together to make this just like extremely artistically complex series of movies. And when you rewatch them, it's like, yes, they're extremely entertaining. But as a critic, watching them as an adult, I was just like blown away by, you know, the lighting, the costume design, the music, which I could talk about for hours. It's just...
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings films are just astonishing. It's things like, well, the swords. Now, you don't get really close-ups of most of the swords, but every one of them, they're made by craftsmen. They've got the... What do you call it? Like the engraving.
The runes and stuff.
Yeah.
And they had all of the pieces of writing. They just had this one calligrapher who was writing like letters that would remain inside envelopes and that sort of thing.
Yes.
The attention to detail in the films is just incredible. I had a behind the scenes book of The Two Towers, but I had it when I was too young to appreciate what I was being told, really. And I was just mostly looking at it for references to draw pictures of the characters.
I mean, I remember my friends and I would all watch and rewatch all of the special features on the DVDs. And honestly, DVD special features, they should bring those back for movies that are released in streaming, because they are really interesting. And the ones for Lord of the Rings, I think they really understood that they wanted to record everything for posterity, because there were so many people involved. And like most average viewers are not going to be aware of the level of work that goes into that stuff. And, you know, the costuming alone is astounding.
Everything. I've got all those behind the scenes books, and, you know, they're just... unbelievable. And of course, filming in New Zealand, I watched that, and I watched the mountains, and I thought, they can't be real. It has to be CGI. But they're real.
They are. It's incredible.
I think there's also something to be said for the quality of them as adaptations. You know, I think about, I mean, Marvel, obviously, adaptations in kind of loose or strict ways from a vast wealth of comic books. But, you know, I think about the film version of The Golden Compass that came out not exactly in that era, a little after, but not too long after. And just the vast gulf of not just quality, but care that went into the adaptation. I mean, I think... The cutting of Tom Bombadil, it's whether or not you like that character, it's a thing that and numerous other shifts or changes, I think, were done really intelligently in terms of bringing this from a, you know, an epic book into an epic film. I also think it's, and I will say, having only seen the first of the Hobbit movies, and, you know, being someone who has, especially to the Hobbit, a deep emotional connection, I think those were really poorly adapted.
Yeah, I elected not to watch those. I was just like, I do not want to see this charming short children's fantasy story turned into three extremely overlong action movies.
Yeah, well, and exactly that. I mean, part of the thing that is so beautiful about The Hobbit is, you know, how many of the problems are solved through cleverness or riddles or, you know, through delaying and playing the trolls off of each other until the sun dawns. And I felt like, at least in the first film, those were all replaced with combat, with, you know, sword fights. And
It felt like Peter Jackson had gone, we had lots of, or I don't know who, it may not have been Peter, but someone had gone, Lord of the Rings had loads of really good battles in it. We should probably put those into The Hobbit, because that's what people liked about Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah.
It was all the battles. I was so disappointed. I went to see The Hobbit at Leicester Square Cinema on like the night it came out, and I had such goosebumps when I heard the old familiar music and I saw the font coming up on the screen. And by the end of it, I was like, oh no, I don't think I liked that very much.
I mean, it kind of turns The Hobbit into just like any other blockbuster franchise. And the thing that's so magical about Lord of the Rings films is that instead of listening to kind of some studio exec that thinks they know what the audience wants and is making decisions based on sort of focus grouping and, you know, three-act structures where you have to have a battle at a certain point, even though the Lord of the Rings movies depart from the source text in some ways, they're extremely emotionally sincere in a way that the vast majority of other movies aren't. And they're kind of, they understand the core themes and the things that you're meant to be feeling when you're just looking at certain things. So like, you get this sense of like nostalgia, or you get this sense of kind of worshipful impressiveness at certain scenarios. And that kind of religiosity is just not something you see in other blockbusters. And also, like I said, like in terms of the emotional sincerity, the fact that it's just like a very sensitive story. Like, they are just completely unironically delving into the emotions of these characters, you know?
Yes.
Which is not something you see a lot in films that are about men, because Hollywood is really into either critical or just like completely endorsing depictions of toxic masculinity. And Lord of the Rings films are like, no, these people all have very close ties and they are very open about their feelings, and we understand that, you know?
There's a really good YouTube video out there. I think it's Pop Culture Detective who did it. So they did this. It's about half an hour long. It's called Boys Don't Cry Except When They Do. And it's a really interesting, because a lot of the videos that they do are about examinations of masculinity and femininity and sexism and society in film. And this video is so interesting for it's a deep dive into the ways in which men are allowed or not allowed to cry and to display vulnerability or weakness. And we do see a lot of vulnerability and weakness in the male characters of The Lord of the Rings in a way that you don't often see.
Well, they're allowed to comfort each other. They're allowed to be warm and affectionate to each other.
Yes.
It can go too far. I got terribly bored by the last bit of, or nearly the last bit, of Return of the King, where Frodo and Sam are sitting on the slopes of Mount Doom. And I kept saying, oh, come on, eagles. Come on. It did go on a bit.
No, that's one of my favourite parts.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's not mine.
They love each other, Sue.
Well, I know. I'm fine. I'm happy with them. But, you know, they don't have to just keep going on and on and on, because it's the problem is that I wanted to get to the bit which, in fact, they didn't show, which was the scouring of the Shire.
Ah.
That was the problem for me. You know, there was a lot of the emoting between Frodo and Sam there, but there wasn't any emoting over the scouring of the Shire, where in the books there is a lot of emoting, especially from Sam, because of the ghastly things that Saruman and his crew have been doing, you know. But because Jackson decided, understandably, to leave that out, and he explains it, of course, in one of the extended versions, you know, the people discussing things. But I missed that, and I just kept thinking, well, you know, if they just cut out about, you know, 5 hours of Frodo and Sam emoting, we could have had the Siren of the Shire. So I got annoyed about that. And Faramir. I got very annoyed about what Jackson did with Faramir.
I think we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back to that in a second, because that sounds like something I want to hear about. And welcome back. So I want to go back briefly, and I want to discuss the difference in the endings between the books and the films. Because as you mentioned, Sue, the scouring of the Shire is taken completely out of the films, but it's a substantial chunk of Return of the King. And it gives a very different feeling to the ending. Because in the films, they come back and the Shire is just how they left it. and in the books, they come back and the war has followed them home. And I'd really love to hear people's opinions on, I guess, on the differences between those two endings. I mean, Sue, you would prefer to have the Scouring stuff in, I guess.
Well, I don't know. When I heard Peter Jackson actually explaining why he'd done it, it made very, very good sense. He basically wanted to end on a more triumphant note.
Yeah, fair.
And the Scouring and the Shire, of course, is very untriumphant. I mean, they win and they beat Lotho and Saruman and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But there's a sort of... It's melancholy, ultimately, isn't it? And I can see exactly why Jackson changed that. And, of course, to be fair, he did have a tiny, tiny bit of it, didn't he? In the
vision.
I can't even remember. Is it the Fellowship of the Ring? Yeah, when they're in Lothlorien.
Yeah.
And Frodo follows Galadriel. And she has that beautiful bowl of water, which is straight from the book, of course. And he looks into it, and what he sees is the Scouring of the Shire.
Yeah.
And then Galadriel says that bit about, you know, it may never happen, and it's only if people perhaps turn aside to try and prevent it. And that's it. So you could say he gets it in a tiny bit.
Yes. Well, but I think there's something... I mean, really looking at that, like how true and difficult of a thing to chew on of, you know, Frodo does everything right and does win and does destroy the ring, and still his worst vision comes true. And like and that's a really powerful thing. So The films are, you know, heavily produced by American companies, and I want to advance the idea that the ending of the films is a much more kind of American understanding of war, with Tolkien in World War I and, you know, looking at things in World War II even. You have a world where the war does come home and is fought on home soil. And for America, you know, the experience of the world wars is going out and fighting and then coming home to a boom and to prosperity and to safety.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the fundamental difference.
That's really interesting. Yeah. That hadn't struck me.
Yeah.
I mean, structurally, it fits much more in with the sort of conventional victory arc. I mean, for me, they're both very different stories. And I think I don't think it's like one is the better one. I think they're both good and just different.
No, no.
But people do still kind of remark about how Frodo's finale at the end of those films, despite the fact that they've given it this much more victorious arc overall, like Frodo's role is still much more downbeat than we're used to seeing. Like, it's not like, oh, life's a party now, because it does actually end with him, you know, he has lifelong trauma and he feels isolated from his original community and he never recovers from it, which is kind of the end of the film. So it still feels very unusually bittersweet for this kind of story.
And I think that's very much there in the films and is really strong in the books in some similar, in some different ways. Yeah, Frodo is... you know, obviously physically is the nine-fingered hobbit, and you know, that gets highlighted a lot, but also just there are all of these descriptions of him having kind of wasted and being thin
pale
and both, and you see that in Bilbo too in Lord of the Rings.
I was about to say that Bilbo did the same thing when he came back from the Lonely Mountain. He also locked himself away and became sort of... But Bilbo was sort of like a friendly eccentric, and Frodo's become a sad eccentric.
Well, and the idea that, you know, Sam stays in the Shire and, you know, continues life, but Frodo and Bilbo kind of... It's maybe freighted as a reward, but kind of have to depart and go into the West because they have been so diminished by the horror of kind of the ring of being corrupted by this thing.
Yeah, and the fact that Frodo was so young when he went away, because like he is effectively kind of 18 in the world of Hobbits, and you know that's very visible in the movies because Elijah Wood was so young when they started filming. And Sam is kind of canonically this established adult.
Actually, he wasn't 18. I think he's more like 30.
Well, no, he's 33, but in terms of the Hobbit
life. I know, but 33 is when Hobbits come of age. But actually, he's older than that. He's 33 when Bilbo is 101. But then there's a stretch of years between. Yes.
He's about 50. Oh, well, I guess I was thinking of the movies where he does just pop off.
Yeah, no, that's right. But he's about 50. In human years, that would be about 30. On the other hand, Merry and Pippin are really, really young.
Okay,
Neither of them have... I think Pippin particularly is about the equivalent of 17. If you look at the family trees in the back of the books, at the back of the Return of the King, you can actually work out all their ages, which, of course, I did. How sad.
This sounds like me organising all of the Sherlock Holmes stories by chronology.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But Geoffrey, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, Bilbo describes himself as feeling stretched, like butter scraped across too much bread. And, of course, he hasn't used the ring very much at all, whereas Frodo is using it and carrying it all the time for 13 months. And he says, doesn't he, towards the end, I've been wounded. I've been wounded by knife and sting and tooth. And it's not just the ring. It's all the other horrible things that have happened to him.
Yeah. Yes. I will say I've become so much more sympathetic to Frodo as I've gotten older. And so much more admiring of like the courage that it takes, because my understanding of trauma has grown a lot since I was, well, obviously since I was like 11. Yes. The idea of having to carry something that to other people might seem small, but to you is like a massive weight in your mind, and it takes everything that you have just to take another step, and then the marks of that staying with you for such a long time. Like, I really empathize with Frodo. I think a lot, especially over the last couple of years, about that phrase, I feel like butter over too much bread. Like, I have, like, that's so relatable lately.
Yeah, I know. It's a wonderful phrase, isn't it?
It is.
But in the end, I think Tolkien did... He says, doesn't he, that in the end, Sam also... went to the last of the ring bearers.
Yeah.
He goes to the West. But I've never quite believed that, because Sam fits so nicely into his world, doesn't he?
I always interpreted that as his love and loyalty to Frodo.
Me too.
Yes, well, I agree about that. I agree. But, and I'm not sure, to be fair, that it's a bit of a throwaway as far as Tolkien's concerned. You know, he says it, but he's not really. He's not really worried that much one way or the other. I'm not sure I am either. But,
I think he followed Frodo. I think that...
Well, he does. He does. I mean, Tolkien says so. So we'll have to believe him. And he was a ring bearer for a little bit.
There's another thing in terms of the adaptation that I think is really powerful in the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings, and I think that is the kind of deep awareness of kind of all of the ancillary material. I feel like Peter Jackson is always in conversation with, also with the Silmarillion.
Yeah.
Even at times where, you know, yes, there are some kind of, they feel a little bit like fan service, like, oh, we're going to throw in Manwë here and things like that. But like, it feels like it is being built in, they are building a reality where those stories and that history exists also.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. I mean, I remember, again, having the Lord of the Rings read to me, I guess it would have been, you know, 5, 6 years old. I had I guess you would say, a lot of like abstract questions.
Yeah.
And my father, having read The Silmarillion, had answers for them. You know, I remember very clearly, the Balrog is down in Moria, and I'm so who is the Balrog? And my dad said, well, Gandalf is kind of like an angel, and the Balrog is one of those. And what I took from that was, okay, so the Balrog and Gandalf are cousins, and they just haven't seen each other for a long time. This is like my cousin Matt and Katie, who live in Utah, and like, okay, yeah. Which, I mean, is... It, but I think the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings has that mythic weight on Gandalf, like, is very clearly not just some human who has learned some spells. You know, this is a creature inhabiting, boy, having also talked about Hannibal with you all, you know, inhabiting a human suit and kind of on par with this 30-foot-tall creature of smoke and fire.
And that's why you hire Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
It's very impressive the way the movies managed to kind of illustrate that sense of there being this really deep world building, because obviously Tolkien attracts a very specific kind of reader who loves to learn a massive amount of information and like study the Silmarillion and all of the appendices and stuff, but you can't put that kind of information in a movie. And whenever a film tries to do that kind of thing and give you loads of lore, it doesn't work because your emotions need to focus on the film, not your brain, really.
Yes,
and the thing that makes Lord of the Rings so good is most of that world building, apart from the stuff that's plot specific, is illustrated visually. So as the movies like travel through Middle-earth, we get this sense of history, even if you're not thinking about it consciously, because you kind of start in Hobbiton and like, because literally you're traveling back in time from Hobbiton in like the 19th century, like rural environment where it's really comforting. And you travel back through these different stages of history as you go to like the elfish lands and like the Viking warriors of Rohan. And then you basically end up in this sort of like primordial volcano at the end. So it's like time travel through architecture and kind of the scenery design and the types of tree and like the size of things. And you just, you engage with that without understanding what you're seeing. And then the more you learn, you're like, wow, I really do understand that there's like this deep history that's happening.
That is a fascinating
That's a very intelligent comment, actually. Yeah. I shouldn't sound surprised.
Thank you. That's why they paid me to do the film criticism.
I can hear the teacher in you there.
Oh, I'm afraid so. Yeah, absolutely. It's,
I as treasure my husband a compliment says,
you can take
teacher.
The girl out of the school when you retire, but you can't take the school out of the girl. So, I think that's... this whole Balrog thing was fascinating because, of course... I read Lord of the Rings when I was 12, which would have been 1964. And The Silmarillion wasn't published till 1977. So I had no idea what this Balrog was. And obviously Gandalf knows.
Did you have a vision in your head? I can't remember how clearly it's described.
I had no vision at all. I'm very bad, actually, at visualising things, and I tend not to do it very much. It's all language for me. So Gandalf says, I am a Balrog and I am already weary. And I thought, what the hell is a Balrog? Well, I don't suppose I thought, what the hell, because I was 12. But, you know, it was that sort of reaction.
Yeah.
And it really isn't, the Balrog isn't described that much.
I
envisaged him insofar as I imagined anything as a creature with wings. Because Tolkien talks about... he has used the word wings, but I think it's metaphorical. And it wasn't until... it's the same with Treebeard. I mean, you know, imagining an ent is really, really hard.
Yes.
And I think
yet,
he did it
pretty
well.
An instant... I know what I think an ent looks like because of the films.
The films.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we're talking about... a gap of almost 40 years between my first reading and when I saw the film, the first film.
Yeah.
And in that time, I think I just didn't really imagine. I couldn't imagine the Balrog, and I didn't imagine the Ent. I loved the Balrog in the films. I wasn't quite so convinced by the Ents? I don't know. Perhaps I'm being unfair to the films. What did you
think? I quite like the Ents. I really liked how they were different kinds of trees, and you could tell what different kinds of trees they were because of the way, shown in like their physicality and stuff like that. Quite liked them.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think it was just the slightly sort of CGI-ishness, really.
Yeah.
Because so much of the rest of the film wasn't CGI, and it was... Oh, I don't know. They did it really well. And I love the idea of going back in time. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
We've almost come to time, so I just want a quick fire question, which I did warn you about before the recording, which is that I would like to hear who your favourite characters are and why. As I've said many times previously, my favourite is Sam. I appreciate a down-to-earth loyal friend very much, but I have different soft spots for all, literally every character, but Sam I think is my fave.
Well, Aragorn is my favorite because he's very cool, and I think Viggo Mortensen's performance and physical beauty are unparalleled, but Legolas is a close second because I think he's just secretly a huge freak. I think Legolas is undercover a very weird character, and I love that for him.
Have you ever done that thing where you watch for Orlando Bloom's facial expressions? Because he only has like 10
just
lines.
Wonderful, marvelous, just empty, nothing going on in the head. I love him.
Just twitching at the distance.
Some primo wig acting.
How about you, Jeffrey?
Oh, if we can expand it, I am going to say Bjorn, the warg skin changer. From The Hobbit is just one of my favorite characters. This, and maybe it's because I too am large and, was built to swing axes and survive the cold, and love cooking for people in my house. But if we're sticking to, Lord of the Rings, I am going to say Gandalf. Just as a powerful, wise, and I am always attracted to characters that are shaped like people but are kind of expanded out and are in fact lots of dimensions folded in and packed in tightly.
Yeah. Also, Gavia, thanks for... I think it was you earlier who mentioned that Gandalf and Odin have lots of similarities, because I don't know why it hadn't occurred to me beforehand, but of course they're similar in terms of like an old man walking around with a hat and a stick. And Sue, do you have a favourite character?
Yeah, well, really, my favourite character is Sam. I agree totally.
Yes.
And for the same reasons as yours, Helen. But we can't have the same character for this. So I'm going to choose in the book... and to some extent in the film, Eowyn, who
good choice.
I just love her. Oh, I don't know. She's the original strong woman, but most of the strong women in modern films are completely stupidly unrealistic. You know, someone who's sort of 5 foot tall and weighs about 100 pounds and beating up sort of 6 foot 8 guys. And that's silly. But Eowyn... she's incredibly brave, but equally, she is a sword maiden. She works within her own sphere of skill. So I love her. And also, can I just put in a word in the films for Gollum? Because Andy Serkis is just the most amazing actor. And of course, they only had him originally as a voice actor.
Yeah.
But then they actually based all the film Gollum's movements on Andy Serkis, and he's just exceptional.
No, he's a phenomenon.
It's phenomenon.
Excellent. I really appreciate what he did and what they were able to do with his performance. And that's all we have time for. This has been another one of those conversations where I'm like, everybody is so smart. I'm surrounded by intelligent people. What am I going to do? Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom with me. Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed it as much as we have, or at least as much as I have. I hope that you participants have also enjoyed it.
Oh, yes.
It's been great. Love Lord of the Rings. Love to learn about Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely. I think we've all learnt. It's been really great.
Well, thank you all for coming on. Thank you, listener, for listening. And for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it's goodbye from all of them. Do you want to say goodbye, everybody?
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. It is directed by Helen Gould, produced by Lori Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing, Tessa Vroom, Jeffrey Nils Gardner, and Catherine Ranella. Thanks for listening.